Chapter 12. Exclusion Zone. A young KGB officer named Anatoly Shumak was lucky to get hold of the steering wheel of the van when he did. Otherwise, he and 9 other KGB officers would have ended up in a ditch and might have died. It was late on the night of May the 1st, and the commander of the group refused to disclose their final destination. So secret was the mission for which Shumak had been chosen. As the van moved through the dark streets of Kiev, the commander directed the driver. Right, left, straight, then right again. At some point, frustrated by the last-minute commands, the driver lost his nerve and grabbed his head with his hands, leaving the wheel unattended. Shumak jumped and took control of the vehicle, preventing a crash. Only then did the commander tell the driver that they were going to the Boryspil airport near Kiev. Their task was to receive a special radiation-proof vehicle designed for use by the top Soviet leaders in case of nuclear attack and escort it to Chernobyl. The commander told his subordinates that it was the only vehicle of that type in the Soviet Union, and it would be their responsibility to transport and protect it. They followed orders, and by midday on May the 2nd, the vehicle was at the Chernobyl nuclear plant. Rumor had it that Mikhail Gorbachev himself was going to visit the damaged power plant. Gorbachev never came. His first visit to Chernobyl would take place almost 2 years after the accident, in February 1988. But on the day Shumak and his fellow officers delivered their secret cargo, the site was visited by 2 of Gorbachev's closest assistants, Premier Nikolai Ryzhkov and Gorbachev's second-in-command at the Central Committee, Yegor Ligachev. They flew to Kiev from Moscow on the morning of May the 2nd. From there, in the company of the Ukrainian leaders Volodymyr Chechirbitsky and Oleksandr Lyashko, they took a helicopter to the power plant. Some of those involved after the accident, including the chief scientific advisor of the State Commission, Valery Legasov, believed that the visit was a response to reports from Kiev and other major Ukrainian centers about rising levels of radiation. After having ordered that the Kiev rally proceed as planned, the leaders from Moscow now came to the area to assess the situation for themselves. They brought along their personal dosimeters, but had little understanding of the danger posed by the damaged reactor. As the helicopter approached the nuclear plant, Ryzhkov ordered the pilot to descend and fly over the reactor. The ever more frequent beeping of the instruments turned into a frenzied, continuous wail. The numbers ran up the scale at a furious pace, remembered Lyashko, who was on the flight with Ryzhkov and Ligachev. He recalled that the helicopter had no protection whatsoever against radiation. Ryzhkov believed that there was a lead plate on the bottom, but nothing else. Looking at the reactor, they were able to comprehend for the first time the scope of the damage the explosion had caused, but they were still far from fully understanding the consequences of the disaster. In Chernobyl, the plenipotentiaries of the Kremlin presided over a meeting of the State Commission, only slowly gaining a better appreciation of the enormous problems facing them. Anatoly Majorets, the all-Union Minister of Energy, who was one of the main speakers at the meeting, exuded optimism about the future of the plant. Trying to anticipate the expectations of the senior officials, Majorets concluded his presentation by stating, "We will take all necessary measures and have Unit 4 in working order by October and Unit 5 by December." The director of the plant, Viktor Bruchanov, who was no longer in any position to make decisions, but still present at the meeting, was shocked. Later, he recalled his thoughts on listening to Majorets. And nobody said to him, "Why are you talking nonsense? The unit can't be restored." The atomic experts remained silent, and I couldn't say a word so as not to be expelled from the meeting. One participant who did not remain silent but also did not speak out was Lyashko, the head of the Ukrainian government. "What is he talking about?" he quietly asked Ryzhkov. "How can any units be brought on stream when a 10-kilometer zone is contaminated with radiation above the normal limit?" Ryzhkov did not respond. The meeting went on. It was a hot day in May. The windows were open, and next to one of them sat Volodymyr Chechirbitsky, chain-smoking cigarettes. He wiped tears from his eyes with a handkerchief. He was probably suffering from a spring allergy, but the situation was grim enough to justify real tears. Not all the speakers were as optimistic as Majerets. General Vladimir Pikolov, the commander of chemical units in the region, reported on radiation levels, and leading scientists left no doubt that radioactivity was high and increasing every day. The head of the All-Union Meteorological Agency, Yuri Israel, produced a map of the contaminated areas around the power plant. They extended up to 30 kilometers with the locations of radioactive tongues and dirty spots depending on the direction and strength of winds at the time of the explosion and in the following days. Many members of the State Commission believed that the 10-kilometer exclusion zone, on which they had agreed earlier, would have to be extended. Ryzhkov, who was slowly grasping the extent of the problem caused by the spreading radiation, asked how large the new exclusion zone should be. Those present suggested a radius of 30 kilometers, although there were some clean spots within that area. Ryzhkov later recalled, "We had several sources of information, ecologists, geologists, meteorologists, the military and civil defense. We compared all those maps, analyzing why some of the data was inconsistent. We placed all the maps one on top of another and got a blot encompassing the contaminated areas of Ukraine, Belarus, and Russia. I sat thinking for a long time. A decision had to be made." After some hesitation, Ryzhkov went along with the recommendation to create a 30-kilometer zone. The zone would cover more than 2,000 square kilometers of territory, including more than 80 settlements, and result in the additional evacuation of more than 40,000 people. Lyashko recalled the moment of decision somewhat differently. After the meeting in Chernobyl, the senior officials drove to nearby villages to check on the evacuees from Pripyat. Lyashko was in the middle of a conversation with one of the women evacuated from the city when the commander of the civil defense units approached him with the map of contaminated areas produced by General Pikolov and his officers. Lyashko looked at the map and realized that the village they were visiting, to which Pripyat citizens had been evacuated a few days earlier, was itself in the radioactive zone. It was located 20 kilometers from the nuclear plant. Lyashko showed the map to Ryzhkov, who made the final decision on the evacuation of all settlements within the 30-kilometer zone. Lyashko then returned to his conversations with evacuees. The woman with whom he had just spoken complained that the physics teacher in the local school, in whose home she had been billeted with her family, had asked them to move to the summer shack on the premises because they were bearers of radiation. "And I had a fleeting thought," recalled Lyashko later. "What would that teacher who had treated the family of evacuees in unfriendly fashion say if he were ordered to evacuate his dwelling the next day?" The members of the State Commission were pleased with the visit of senior Soviet officials to Chernobyl and the discussions they had there. "That was an important meeting," recalled Valery Legasov. "First of all, they understood from our reports, and it fell to me to be one of the reporters, they understood the situation, grasping that this was not just a local accident, but one of great significance that would have long-term consequences, and that huge efforts would be required to continue localizing the consequences of the damaged unit, that preparations had to be made for large-scale deactivation measures, that a cover for the damaged Unit 4 would have to be designed and built. There was no more talk of restoring Unit 4 to working order or bringing it back on stream by the end of the year. The highest officials in Moscow were beginning to comprehend the consequences of the disaster." Ukrainian officials had mixed feelings about the visit of their superiors from Moscow. Ryzhkov, who took political responsibility for the evacuation of Pripyat and then for extending the exclusion zone, was not above showing the locals who was boss. Considering the medical response to the crisis tardy and inadequate, he was quick to reprimand local officials. After listening to the Ukrainian Deputy Minister of Health complain that he did not have enough ambulances at his disposal, Ryzhkov all but fired him. "That makes you a nobody today," he told the frightened Ukrainian official, because we have enough of everything in the Union. That was the Soviet style of management, deeply rooted in the Stalinist tradition of terrorizing subordinates into meeting their production quotas. The local officials, who felt they were being punished for the shortcomings of the all-union government which ran the plant, were resentful. The party ideologue, Yegor Ligachev, also rubbed the locals the wrong way. Like a commissar, he appealed for responsibility to the party for consolidating communist ranks, remembered Vasil Sinko, the head of the Kiev region's agricultural administration. Vitaly Masol, the head of the Ukrainian planning agency and a member of the state commission investigating the accident, felt that Ligachev had little grasp of the realities of everyday life in the disaster zone. When one of the workers approached Ligachev with the question of whether vodka would be available to those working in the contaminated areas, rumor had it that alcohol helped cleanse the body of radioactive particles, Ligachev responded, "No vodka. We shall observe the resolution of the CC-CPSU Politburo." He had in mind the launch a few months earlier of an all-union anti-alcohol campaign of which he was a sponsor. "At that point I became impatient and intervened," recalled Masol. "Don't worry," I told the worker. "You'll get 100 to 200 grams of vodka in the dining hall." Vasil Tsinko was struck by what he considered Ligachev's lack of empathy for the locals. He remembered Ligachev saying, "Well, it's certainly a great misfortune, but we'll learn from your experience." "Those words simply finished me," recalled Tsinko. "So the point of the whole disaster was to let the USSR learn from our misfortune." He suspected that Moscow regarded the Ukrainians as guinea pigs. "So that was why there was no evacuation order for such a long time," wrote Tsinko, recalling his thoughts many years later. "Obviously, the Moscow bosses wanted to see how radiation would affect the health of Ukrainians." The Chernobyl disaster was slowly driving a wedge between party officials in Ukraine and their bosses in Moscow. The former had to deal with the consequences of the disaster, although they had no control over the nuclear plant, while the latter visited, reprimanded, and fired those whom they held responsible for failing to keep the situation under control. Even the KGB operatives were unhappy. Scores of them absorbed high doses of radiation while sitting for hours in the bushes in contaminated areas around the power plant. They had been posted there to protect members of the leadership from possible attack or assassination. On May the 3rd, the day after the departure of Kremlin representatives from Ukraine, Oleksandr Lyashko called a meeting of a special commission of the Ukrainian Politburo dealing with the consequences of the Chernobyl disaster. With the all-union authorities and the state commission trying to stop radioactive emissions from the reactor, the Lyashko commission focused on the refugee crisis and protecting the civilian population from radiation. It was a difficult task, partly because the authority of the Ukrainian commission was limited by policies made in Moscow regarding the release of information. The Lyashko commission had to protect people without telling them what was going on. The rising radiation levels were the primary concern of Lyashko and his colleagues. Since the first days of the disaster, the Ukrainian KGB and the Ministry of Health had been reporting daily to party headquarters in Kiev on the number of people affected by radiation sickness. It was growing among adults and children alike. According to KGB reports, 54 people had been admitted to Ukrainian hospitals with symptoms of radiation poisoning on April the 28th. That day, the Politburo in Moscow learned of 170 cases throughout the USSR. On May the 1st, Pravda wrote of 197 people admitted to hospitals. By the morning of May the 3rd, there were 911 such patients in Ukraine alone, and by May the 4th, 1,345 patients. The number of children with symptoms of radiation poisoning grew as well, from 142 on May the 3rd to 330 on May the 4th. With the radiation sickness wards created in Kiev's hospitals full or approaching capacity, the medical authorities prepared hospitals outside Kiev and were ready to take in an additional 1,680 patients. Anatoly Romanenko, the Ukrainian Minister of Health, urged members of the Liashko Commission who had been travelling to Chernobyl to have checkups at government clinics. He reported that 230 medical brigades were being sent to the Chernobyl area to deal with the growing radiation crisis. Given the shortage of medical personnel, many of those sent to the area were students of medical schools in Kiev. With the KGB reporting that parents were protesting the dispatch of young female students of nursing schools to the exclusion zone, mobilization was limited to the male students of the medical schools in the 6- and 7-year programs. The announcement to prepare for a trip to the zone had been made in the middle of classes on the morning of May the 4th, recalled one of the mobilized students, Maxim Drach, the son of the prominent Ukrainian poet Ivan Drach. "We got into the bus feeling happy and joking," he remembered. Maxim and his friends were assigned to dosimeter control posts on the borders of the exclusion zone. It was a heartbreaking scene. "Those who came were mainly old, hunchbacked men and women and small children," recalled Maxim. He and his friends had no protective gear, and after spending a few days patrolling the zone, they ended up in hospitals themselves. Ukrainian officials were struggling with the question of what could and should be said about the danger posed by the reactor to the general public. The continuing information blockade, orchestrated from Moscow, was nowhere as obvious and scandalous as in the exclusion zone itself. There, the Pripyat newspaper ceased publication after the accident, but the Chernobyl newspaper Prapor Peremohi, Flag of Victory, continued to appear, although it was forbidden to publish anything about the accident or its consequences. As people in the region developed radiation sickness and packed their bags in response to evacuation orders, the paper published not a word about the accident, either in its issue of April the 29th, the first to appear after the explosion, or in the next issue, dated May the 1st. On the front page of the latter was an image of Lenin and a selection of party slogans, one of which, taken from Gorbachev's report to the 27th Party Congress, asserted, "The Soviet people may be assured that the party is deeply aware of its responsibility for the country's future." At the meeting of the Liashko Commission, Anatoly Romanenko pushed for more openness. "Our way is to tell people the truth, but we are avoiding it," he told the gathering. But Liashko, mindful of the monopoly on information exercised by Moscow, was reluctant to make any public statement on the accident. He shot down a proposal to produce a television report on the damaged power plant and proposed to postpone discussion of the issue until the next day, when they would have a better understanding of the situation. Stepan Mucha, the head of the Ukrainian KGB, did not object. His only concern was the coordination of information policy with Moscow. "Moscow issues data without coordinating it with us," he said. "They write that 17 people are gravely ill. We write 30. They decided to do nothing." At the next meeting of the commission on May the 4th, Liashko finally told Romanenko to prepare information for the general public on how to protect themselves from radiation. He added, "Tomorrow we'll present the text to the Ukrainian Politburo, and if permission is granted, we'll issue it later in the day." Subservience to Moscow was part and parcel of the historical DNA of the Ukrainian political elite. Ukrainian officials postponed public announcements they considered essential for the protection of public health, and downplayed the severity of the ecological impact of radiation because they feared being reprimanded by Communist Party bosses. They were determined to fulfill government quotas for agricultural production in the severely contaminated areas. The Soviet government had trouble feeding its citizens, importing 45 million tons of grain and close to 1 million tons of meat in 1985 alone. Moscow relied on a steady supply of agricultural products from Ukraine, the breadbasket of the Soviet Union. The Liashko Commission ordered the police and military to patrol the exclusion zone. It was less clear what to do with all the crops in the fields. Peasants leaving the zone had to abandon not only their houses, but also 10,000 hectares of winter crops and 13,000 hectares of spring ones, as well as 45,000 hectares of planted potatoes. Not fully understanding the effects of radiation, the authorities tried to save what they could of the affected crop. Radioactive contamination presents almost no danger to the growth of crops. Oleksandr Takachenko, the over-optimistic Ukrainian Minister of Agriculture, told the Liashko Commission on May the 4th. There is a loss of 25 to 30% of winter crops at 80 Rontgens, and complete loss at 330 Rontgens. The numbers they received were much lower. Whatever radiation did not kill immediately was good enough to be consumed, according to the leaders of the Ukrainian collective farming sector. It was only after Moscow officials refused to take Ukrainian vegetables for sale in their city's stores and markets that the Ukrainian authorities began to question their own policies. For the time being, however, they allowed the production of butter from the contaminated milk of cows eating radioactive grass. In a country with chronic food shortages, they believed that they could not refuse any agricultural products, including those from the exclusion zone. As Liashko and his colleagues debated what to do and how much to say about the disaster, the radiation situation in and beyond the newly created 30-kilometer zone was rapidly deteriorating. Radiation levels that had been declining after the explosion began to rise again. On April the 27th, the reactor released close to 4 million curies of radioactive particles. By May the 1st, that amount had dropped by half, but it jumped back to 4 million curies on May the 2nd, the day when Ryshkov and Ligachev toured the area. On May the 3rd, the radioactivity release reached 5 million curies, and on May the 4th, it climbed to 7 million. What had caused that dramatic increase of radioactivity, and where would it lead? Nuclear scientists were at a loss. One theory was that the 5,000 tons of sand, lead, clay and boron dropped onto the reactor were preventing heat exchange between the core of the reactor and the outside air, while still allowing oxygen to get into the reactor and accelerate the burning of graphite in its core. It was decided to stop the airdrops, but the situation continued to deteriorate. There was concern that the overheated reactor, weighed down by the heavy load, would burn its way through the concrete foundations to the basement of Unit 4, which was full of water pumped there during the first hours after the accident. That could lead to another explosion, potentially much more powerful than the one of April the 26th. Some argued that up to 10% of the reactor's core had been blasted into the atmosphere. If that was true, then the remaining 90% might be hurled thousands of kilometers from Chernobyl, making the first explosion an overture to a global disaster. While the scientists were confused and unsure about what to expect, the local authorities were terrified by prospects of a new explosion. Preoccupied with the logistics of uprooting tens of thousands of people, the managers did not lose sight of the state of the reactor, which they knew to be worsening. There was one major indicator to watch, the temperature within the reactor. They could find no way of arresting the temperature of the reactor, which kept rising by 100 degrees every 24 hours, remembered Vasil Sinko, the agricultural chief of the Kiev region, who attended the meetings of the State Commission and understood the full extent of the danger. At the time of the accident, the temperature was 1,200 degrees. A value of 2,200 degrees was defined as a critical threshold that the reactor could not be permitted to attain, as it might result in a new explosion hundreds of times greater than the previous one. In that case, Ukraine and Europe as a whole would become a desolate wasteland. Sinko learned of the new danger emanating from the reactor at a meeting of the State Commission that he attended late on the night of May the 2nd. And so, at 3 a.m. on May the 3rd, I was walking to my workplace after that meeting, he recalled. Buses full of people passed, and trucks with livestock, all bellowing, squealing, mooing. And I counted on my fingers April the 26th, the 27th, 28th, 29th, 30th, May the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, in which time the temperature of the reactor had already risen by 800 degrees, attaining 2,000 degrees Celsius on that symbolic thermometer. So the terrible, irreparable event could happen at any moment, although, theoretically, 2 days remained until the critical point was reached. That night, Sinco managed to save thousands of people from continuing exposure to radiation. In the previous days, the military had built a pontoon bridge across the Desna River that would make it possible to evacuate the population and domestic animals from areas north of the river. The bridge helped with the evacuation but disrupted the normal navigation of vessels. By May the 3rd, there were dozens of ships near the bridge that could not proceed to deliver their cargoes to ports in Belarus. The head of the State Commission, Boris Chechervina, ordered that the pontoon bridge be temporarily dismantled so the ships could get through. Sinko was terrified when he learned of Chechervina's order. Following it would mean stopping buses loaded with passengers and trucks full of animals from leaving the left bank of the Desna and finding safety south of the river. If they were unable to cross, the people would spend the night on buses, absorbing radiation. And what would the hungry livestock do? It was frightening even to think about that, recalled Sinko. Along with the regional party boss, he managed to convince Chechervina to let the people and animals pass before the bridge was disassembled to let the ships proceed. Sinko breathed a sigh of relief. Among the Chernobyl area evacuees forced to abandon their homes during the first days of May were the parishioners of an Orthodox church from the village of Krasno near Chernobyl. The orders to evacuate the village came as a complete surprise to the parish priest, Father Leonid, who believed not only in God, but also in the power of Soviet science. "We now have powerful science, so they fix all the problems," he told his wife soon after the explosion. Father Leonid's belief in the power of science came crashing down on May the 2nd, which happened to be Good Friday. Around 2 p.m., as he was celebrating the liturgy in his village church, parishioners came to tell him that there were visitors from the Communist Party Committee in Chernobyl. They were calling a meeting of the entire adult population of the village. The service had to be stopped. The party officials told the peasants that they had 4 hours to get ready for evacuation. The power plant was too close for them to stay any longer. Indeed, from their church on the hill, Father Leonid and his parishioners could see helicopters dropping their loads on the reactor. As in Pripyat, the people of Krasno were told that they would be leaving for 3 days and should take only essentials with them. But the evacuation of villages presented problems that urban evacuations did not. There were cows, pigs, geese, and rabbits, whose owners insisted on taking them along. Trucks dispatched to pick up cattle finally arrived at 2 a.m. on May the 3rd. "You should have seen what went on," recalled Father Leonid. "They wrote down data, who was delivering how many head of livestock, their weight, and they loaded the animals onto the trucks and took them to the designated places. It was only when the sun had risen and the cattle were gone that buses started to pick up the villagers. I was among the people," remembered Father Leonid, "visiting the sick, giving communion to those who required communion. There were old men and women there, sick people who had lain ill for years. Some refused to be evacuated. 'We are staying here, Father. We're not going anywhere. We're going to die in any case,' they told the priest. Father Leonid did his best to persuade the elderly to leave with their families. Grudgingly, they followed his advice. The priest closed the church, leaving all his garments and icons, in the hope of a speedy return, gave the keys to the head of the parish and boarded a bus. Finally, the buses started to move. 'As we departed Krasno,' recalled Father Leonid, 'everyone was grieving on leaving home. People wept. They all blessed themselves, making the sign of the cross in hopes of returning.'" In the atmosphere of rising tension and complete uncertainty, even communist members of the village administration began to pay attention to the priest and the church he represented. One of the officials offered to have a drink with Father Leonid when they returned. When the priest responded that he did not drink, the official told him, "No problem. You're a priest and we're communists. When we come back and there is nothing to fear, we'll drink 100 grams each for such delight. As long as we come back." They never did. Having had his service interrupted in his own church, Father Leonid celebrated the Easter liturgy in Chernobyl. The night vigil ended with the blessing of Easter bread at 3 a.m. on Easter Sunday, May the 4th. At 9 a.m., Father Leonid, his son, and the remaining inhabitants of Chernobyl boarded buses and left the city. The Easter exodus from Chernobyl had begun. The head of the Kiev region's agricultural administration, Vasil Sinko, his communist credentials aside, celebrated Easter in the old Orthodox fashion as well. He had returned to his staff after the meeting of the State Commission on the night of May the 3rd, depressed but also defiant. Facing what might be a global catastrophe, he refused to follow what he considered ridiculous orders coming from the top. After telling his subordinates to stop compiling data for the civil defense authorities, who were trying to keep track of the number of animals evacuated from the exclusion zone, Sinko told the colonel in charge to get lost. The colonel threatened to report Sinko's insubordination to his authorities, but Sinko did not care. He believed that he was responsible to a higher authority. The Orthodox Easter was coming. We brought potatoes and marinated mushrooms from the cellar, placed a bottle of alcohol on the table, and had a festive supper, or, more properly, breakfast, said Sinko, recalling his Easter meal with staff members. For it was Easter morning. Although we considered ourselves atheists then, after the disaster we recalled the prophecies of our wise grandparents about the end of the world, and began to gaze at the heavens in supplication. Someone is there, after all, someone much stronger and more influential than the CPSU, so everything is in his hands. In the face of disaster, atheists were turning into believers, and the power of communist ideology, like that of Moscow, was dissolving under the influence of the radiation in Chernobyl. Easter Sunday turned out to be the worst day on record for radioactive emissions from the reactor. They increased from 5 million curies the previous day to 7 million. According to KGB reports, radiation levels near the reactor that amounted to 60 to 80 röntgens per hour on May the 1st rose to 210 röntgens per hour on May the 4th. Moreover, scientists recorded an increase of ruthenium-103 in radioactivity from the reactor. Since ruthenium melts at temperatures above 1,250 degrees Celsius, this was evidence of mounting heat within the reactor. Then came Monday, May the 5th, bringing another major increase in radiation levels. That day the reactor produced a record amount of radiation, estimated at anywhere from 8 million to 12 million curies. Having no influence over what was going on at the power plant, the Ukrainian authorities did their best to speed up evacuation from the exclusion zone. On May the 3rd, the evacuation of inhabitants, 9,864 people, from the 10-kilometer zone to Borodyanka County was completed. 12,180 head of large horned cattle were also evacuated, read a KGB report for that day. Complete evacuation from the 30-kilometer zone is scheduled for May the 4th and 5th. It was easier said than done. About 30,000 more people were subject to new evacuation orders. The evacuation was carried out with great difficulty, recalled Vasil Sinko. The impression was that a war was going on. There were instances of panic, confusion, and ill-considered decisions. Nevertheless, what prevailed in the actions of those in charge of taking people out of the zone was stamina, courage, and self-sacrifice. Everyone knew that every day and hour spent in the zone would have a deadly effect on the organism of every individual. Many of the locals, both officials and rank-and-file workers and peasants who could remember the days of World War II, compared the evacuation with their wartime experiences, when people were either shipped east by the Soviet authorities or had to flee to the forest to avoid German retribution for partisan activity. But this was different. Back then they knew who the enemy was, and the forest provided them with cover. Now danger was everywhere, and the forest which had helped them survive during the great Ukrainian famine of 1932 to 1933 and sheltered them against German reprisals was the most dangerous place to be. Leaves on the trees and grass accumulated radioactivity at an extremely high rate. One of the forested areas near Pripyat soon became known as the Reddish Forest. The Scotch pines turned red as a result of heavy radioactive contamination. The name of one of the nearby villages, Strakolisia, or Fearsome Forest, suddenly took on a new and disturbing meaning.